The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
If you looked at our coverage of China 10 years today, it was China that was taking over the world, China is unstoppable. If you look at coverage of China now, it's China is in crisis, is China going to collapse, is China going to implode? And one of the arguments I'm going to make is that just as the stuff 10 years ago was overdone, was overblown, so the stuff today about China is equally overblown. So to put the idea of China being in crisis in some sort of context, first of all, you know, from 1978, China produced 1% of the world's GDP and had an economy. The best thing you could say about the Chinese economy in 1978 was that China was basically capable of feeding its population. It is now the world's second largest economy, the world's largest exporter, and the only country that challenges the USA economically, politically, and militarily. A challenge to American imperialism that American imperialism really hasn't seen since its rise at the beginning of the 20th century when, let's say, you know, the UK and Germany play the same part. But it's important not to exaggerate. The US is still a far bigger economy, still a much greater political power. But China challenges US imperialism economically in a way that the old Soviet Union never did, and challenges American political and military hegemony in ways that Western powers and Japan did not do during the Cold War. And so it's no wonder that back in the 1990s, the Project for the New American Century identified China as the number one threat to the USA. I don't know if anyone ever even still acknowledges the existence of the Project for the New American Century or whether they sort of finally closed up and set up shop, but it's clearly, you know, it's clearly the idea that this would be America's century has been very much taken over by the idea that this would be China's century. And even though economic growth has slowed down to just under 7%, so the Indian economy is now growing at a faster rate than China. Nevertheless, at that, China's growth rate is still twice that of the US and far, far higher than the vast majority of other advanced industrial nations. So crisis needs qualification. There is not an economic crisis in China, but there are a series of crises that China's rules have to address. A crisis of economic strategy, an acute environmental crisis, a crisis in external relations, in particular with Southeast Asia, and pressures from below which constrain the choices that China's rulers can make. Crisis is perhaps slightly too strong a term for the last, but nevertheless it's of fundamental importance in terms of looking at the future evolution of Chinese society. So I'm going to look at each of those in turn, but I want to begin with a sketch of how China got to where it is today and to make the fundamental point that all of the problems that China's rulers currently face are problems of their success. It's not simply that China's crises don't simply show that capitalism doesn't work. What they also show is that when capitalism does work, the way in which it works produces the seeds of its own crises. Now, I also need to say that I'm going to broad brush sketch a general picture. I could speak about each of these areas for 20 minutes. Warning to the chair. And this is particularly true of the first thing I'm going to do, how China got here. So rather than keep using the phrase, I'm going to say I could say a lot more about that. That means I could say a lot more about it, but I don't have time to, so it may be something you want to pick out in discussion. The reform era in China opened up in 1978, so has lasted for most of the lives of most of the people here. It's normal as far as you're concerned. But it represented a rejection of the way in which Mao had run China since 1949 and led to changes almost as far-reaching as those of 1949. I'm going to particularly fast forward to 1980, it's a good idea in any case, and I'll pick out just three developments which have helped to define the situation today. The first is the abolition of the communes and the establishment of private use of the land, individual peasant families farming individual plots, are paying a certain amount of taxes, keeping the surplus. This led in turn to the growth of what were called township and village enterprises, small-scale factories owned by private individuals or local governments, which by late 1980s were employing some 80 million people who were no longer being employed on land. And one of the things that crucially made this possible was the fundamental shift of economic power within the state. China's growth was not a product of privatization, of the growth of private capital, but rather of economic power being articulated, being given from the center to local governments at all levels of the state. So creating a great dynamism in the system, but also huge opportunities for local corruption. So the 1980s model collapsed in the political economic crisis that produced the Tiananmen Square explosion. And when the economy rebooted in the early 1990s, it was on a completely different basis, essentially exporting manufactured and assembled goods, mainly textiles, clothing and footwear at first, but then rapidly electronics. The example that sticks in my mind is that in 2001, China did not have a DVD recorder producing industry. By 2005, the majority of DVD recorders in the world were being produced in China. That was the speed of the transformation. The southeast coast from Shanghai down around to Hong Kong became the centre of an explosion of industry geared towards assembling consumer goods for export, overwhelmingly mainly to the USA, fueled by what seemed like an endless supply of migrant workers from the countryside and a huge influx of foreign, mainly East Asian, but then latterly American and European capital. And the result was explosive rates of growth, close on 10% year after year, but also huge rises in inequality along a number of different dimensions between the coastal provinces and inland China, between the city and the countryside, and most of all between the rich and the poor. Just a couple of figures to give a sense of the scale of that. In 2010, per capita income in Shanghai, China's richest city, was six times what it was in the poorest province. In 2012, Beijing University published a survey showing the richest 5% of the population gets 23% of total household income. The poorest 5%, half of 1%. There's a thing called the Gini coefficient. Do people know what the Gini coefficient is? Mm-hmm. Yeah, cool, okay. They no longer publish the Gini coefficient for China. They haven't published it for about five or six years. The last one they published showed the Gini coefficient, the measure of inequality in China, higher than that for the USA. Excuse me. But the other dimension of that inequality was that you saw on the one hand an explosive growth of employment in some parts of the country, but equally a mass layoffs in the state sector, which led to near insurrectionary protests in 2002-2003, but also unemployment levels of up to 80% in some northeastern cities, because with the exception of Shanghai, the places where old state industries laid off massive numbers of workers were not the places where the new exporting industries were being founded. The effects on gender equality were much more mixed. I mean, the very short summary, I guess, would be that younger women basically won, older women basically lost. Young women made up a huge part of the migrant workforce, and for them, getting out of the village and earning an independent village marked a real gain in economic independence, however awful the working conditions might be in the factories. But 2/3 of the jobs lost in the state sector were women's jobs, and women's average urban wages fell to just 70% of men's wages by 2000, compared to the 85% they'd been 10 years previously. So you see a real difference in fortunes according to which part of the working class people were in. And again, this huge growth also led to a further explosion of official corruption, to the point where, I mean, with people have seen in recent years some very high profile politicians being jailed for corruption, on the basis essentially of they've been picked out because of faction fights within the Chinese Communist Party, the CCP leadership, but also on the basis that if you want to go for your factional opponent at any point in a position, you are going to find that you are going to find their hands in the till. It is that level of corruption is now endemic, and there is nothing, you know, the state can move people around from place to place. They can't, however, get rid of it. That boom began in the 1990s, ran up to 2008. Two things are important about that. The first is that it was unsustainable. The sheer volume of growth meant that it was the markets that those factories were exporting to could simply not absorb that level of products. That's the first thing. The second thing was almost none of the commentators saw that coming. So that there was already a problem before 2008, and then came 2008. An immediate crash, some 25 to 30 million workers lost their jobs. The government very quickly put in place a huge program of public and infrastructure spending, which gave a boost to the economy, reduced unemployment, and for that matter, helped to restart the world economy after 2008. There's an estimation that China directly contributed half of all the growth in the world economy between 2007 and 2012. The indirect contribution in terms of stimulating export industries in the countries it was importing from, it made that even greater. But that has led to a huge increase in debt. China's debts are now 250% of its gross domestic product, though that's lower than the USA's on 300%, and also a huge slowing in economic growth. So I'm going to turn now to the current situation and look at really where they're at is essentially a position of stasis. State spending continues at a very high level. China remains the world's largest exporter. There have been some exporting jobs have moved to even lower wage economies, but relatively few, partly because no other country has the sheer size of workforce that China has. And one of the things that has mitigated the drop in growth figures is the massive drop in the oil price, because China imports almost all of its oil. Lower oil prices are a good thing for China. The crisis is really one of direction. Growth figures have declined every year since 2008, bar one. Annual growth is now half of what it was in 2007, and there's no obvious way that is going to be reversed. The exporting figures will never return to the levels they were at previously, because the Western economies are never going to be growing at the level they were previously, or rather, credit in the Western economies will never grow at the rate it was growing previously. The state spending on infrastructure cannot go on forever, because there are only so many bridges, roads and airports you can build. Before 2008, there were 7 airports being built in the 90-mile corridor between Hong Kong and Guangzhou. Cargo airports rather than passenger airports, but even so, 7 airports in 90 miles. Think about the, you know, think about the air traffic implications. And there are a number of huge pressing problems that the ruling class has no answer to. I'm just going to pick out 3 for now. The debt, the environment, and the shrinking workforce. Now, there's an awful lot of coverage about China's debt problem in the American press. So much of it talks about it as though the Chinese banking system is like the American banking system was before 2008. Somewhere there are independent auditors who will come in and take a look at the books and say, you're bankrupt, we're going to close you. Now, of course, that didn't happen to the American banking system in 2008. The American banking system was simply too big to fail. And in reality, almost all of the debt China has the advantages, almost all of the debt is internal, and it's simply a matter of one part of the state owing another part of the state money. So it is true that the Chinese banking system is technically insolvent, but the key word there is technically. A quick bit of audience participation. If your student loans, mortgages, credit card debts, and any other debts exceed the amount of money that you could immediately lay your hands on in terms of checking accounts, saving accounts, raise your hands. Okay, that's technical insolvency. I'm surprised it's so few of us, actually. But that's what it means. That's what it simply means to be technically insolvent. If someone asked you to pay back everything that's owed, you couldn't do it. The Chinese banking system is technically insolvent. Now, at one level, they can simply roll over those debts year in, year out. But nevertheless, it remains a fundamental problem for them, partly because it means that the discipline of the market is not working. Liquidity is being used to prop up inefficient companies. They're not getting the gains in productivity that would come from inefficient companies going out of business and other more efficient companies coming in to replace them. And of course, much of the increases in liquidity are stolen by corrupt officials or recycled over into further grey markets, and thus further reducing waste, and thus further reducing the government's control over investment. And that's why a key part of the security crackdown that Xi Jinping has been involved in has involved periodic tightening of lending regulations to try and limit the credit availability, to try and discipline these institutions into using their assets more effectively. But of course, for many officials, this directly threatens their positions, and therefore they kick back against such moves. It's too soon to say that it hasn't worked at all, but it's certainly not had the results that were expected. The environment, I'm not going to quote too many figures because there is nothing to say about the environment in China that isn't fundamentally depressing. Just a few things. 15 of the world's 20 most polluted cities are in China. Groundwater sources are drying up across North China, getting badly polluted elsewhere. The river systems are drying up to the extent that in some years the Yellow River no longer reaches the sea. There has been massive deforestation because it's been left to individual peasant families to cut down the woods that they need for housing, for other agricultural needs. There's been no sense of husbanding the overall resources, and millions of hectares of agricultural land have been lost to either pollution or to building or to both. China has been a net importer of food since 2001. China imported food previously, but imported and exported both. It's now net importing. The cost of environmental damage is estimated as possibly as much as 8% of GDP. And in Tibet, which is for environmentalists is known as the third pole because of the sheer volume of water held in glaciers, held in frozen tundra, global warming may be causing irreversible damage, which is going to impact not just China, but most of East and South Asia, almost all of East and South Asia's rivers rise on the Tibetan plateau. If there is fundamental global warming effects, that is going to affect the huge parts of Asia. And lastly, the question of the shrinking workforce. The workforce has been declining since 2012, more people dying or retiring than young people joining. And this is because the one-child policy, which has been in effect since 1978, is coming back to use a technical Marxist term, to bite them in the ass. What this gives workers additional muscle. This massively limits the policy implications, the options of the ruling class, and it's also really not reversible in anything like the short term. Not least because in the early years, the imposition of the one child policy involved serious amounts of force being used, forced abortions, checks on women's control, real attacks on women's reproductive rights. In recent years, precisely because China has become more prosperous, actually the idea that families just having one child has become okay. I mean, they're even it's even estimated that China's population growth would probably have contracted by roughly the same proportion anyway, even if they hadn't imposed the policy, simply because or you know, as societies get more prosperous. Okay, as societies get more prosperous, people tend to have smaller and smaller families. So what are the policy options for them? One that's been canvassed for some time is increasing consumption. You will see the same newspapers that talk about how there isn't money to spend on the health service, on education in America or in Western Europe, will also tell the Chinese ruling class that they have to spend extra amounts of money on these things, because there is massive amounts of money tied up in Chinese workers' savings, because they need a very big cushion for education costs, for healthcare costs, for other costs. So there's a possibility of increasing consumption, but that has massive resource implications. It also means you have to persuade employers that they should pay their workers more, which isn't the easiest sell for any government. Another is simply import substitution. China imports massively the raw materials and the components that go into the manufactured goods. If those were made in China, mined in China, then that would be a boost. That would be a boost to the economy. The first part of it, the assembly, is a possibility. The mining thing is, however, much more problematic, because most of the mineral deposits that China could easily get at have been exhausted, and the ones that are left are ones in very remote, very mountainous regions, where simply the cost of the infrastructure to get roads into those areas in order to do the mining, to get the stuff out, is going to be hugely expensive. So they're going to do some of that, but the reality is neither of those are going to restore the growth rates of the early years of this century. China's rulers face a squeeze between the continuing prospect of lower growth for the foreseeable future, plus an expectation of higher living standards from the population. And there's no simple way that they can jump back from that. I'm going to talk fairly briefly about China and the world. But this is again a source of major headaches for the Chinese ruling class. China has now, as I said, is the biggest trading economy, the biggest exporting economy, overcoming the US a few years ago. It's the number one trading partner for almost every country in Asia, for Australia, Brazil, China, 17 countries in Africa. So if the Chinese economy contracts, those economies which have boomed on the basis of supplying China also massively contract. It used to be the case, for instance, a few years ago, that part of what made it possible for Hugo Chavez to defy American imperialism was the sure and certain knowledge that China would buy every drop of oil that Venezuela produced and would pay a sufficiently high price to keep Venezuelan state afloat. Neither of those things are true anymore. China no longer has a demand, and even if China did have the demand, it's simply not paying the money. So there have been, on the basis of the Chinese economy contracting, there have been similar major contractions in economies around the world. excuse me, but that's also the political problems, because someone said in Curry's meeting this morning that one of the differences between American imperialism and Chinese imperialism is that Chinese imperialism has been very clever at constructing alliances across Asia, compared to the crass, insensitive behaviour of American imperialism. That was true. I mean, that was certainly true for the Bush years. That was certainly true for the Clinton years. That stopped being true for the last 4 or 5 years. China, in particular, in the South China Sea, has been throwing its weight around in a way that's managed to alienate more or less every other government in the immediate area, and has given, in effect, the USA the opportunity to come back with TTIP, with the combination of the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and the Pivot to Asia, which have to be seen as two halves of an integrated, you know, whether it's coincidence or not, but for the first time American imperialism actually has an intelligent, integrated response to Chinese to the rise of China in East Asia, and it's essentially predicated on saying, look, we have no territorial ambitions, or apart from your military bases, we just want to defend you against those big bad Chinese. And it is having some traction. I mean, it is, I've said this before, but to people of my generation, it is heartbreaking to see the American Navy sailing back into Cameron Bay, sailing back into Vietnam, the place where they were kicked out from in 1975, and being invited back by the people who kicked them out, because the Vietnamese government now thinks that actually China is a bigger danger than American imperialism is. So you have that series of huge tensions, which again with Taiwan in particular has blown two things very recently. Firstly, China has cut off a series of negotiations with Taiwan because the Taiwanese president refused to acknowledge that Taiwan is part of China. And a couple of days ago, a Taiwanese Navy boat accidentally fired a missile which killed a Chinese fishing boat captain. So, you know, the confrontations between China and Taiwan, China and other countries in the South China Sea, are ones that are by and large not rebounding to China's advantage. China is having real problems in asserting its position against these countries, and this is, as I say, allowing American imperialism a way in. China's rise is in some ways an indicator of the decline of the USA, but we shouldn't forget, obviously, that the USA remains a massively the biggest imperialist power. So when you talk about what's happening in the South China Sea, the most important thing, of course, is saying we don't want to see American imperialism invading, racking up tensions, but it's important to remember that we mustn't in any way alibi what China has been doing in that area, because the reality is it has been Chinese actions that has largely allowed American imperialism to sell themselves as the lesser evil option. Now, what's happened in China since 1978 is generally seen as part of the world advance of neoliberalism. But I want to say, I think that's not the most useful way to look at it. Certainly as a political project, because if you look at the classic neoliberal political projects, Thatcher and Reagan, they were about managing a sluggish economy, which was never going to return to the growth rates of the post-war boom, and they were also about weakening, if not destroying, a labour movement which had enough power to make serious dents in ruling class plans. Those were not the issues that Deng Xiaoping and his colleagues in Chinese ruling class faced in 1978. However, one of the most important features of post-Mao China has been the huge rise of popular protest. This is the bit I'm going to finish on. The government calls these mass group incidents, and again, they stopped publishing figures for how many of these happen. The last useful one is an estimation of 180,000 in 2012, and it's useful assumption that numbers have not dropped since. That category covers everything from village protests against local taxes, environmental protests, fighting back against bullying cops, strikes, nationalist protests in Tibet and in Xinjiang. And these have been at times large enough and militant enough to change central government policy on rural in the countryside, on rural taxation in the 1990s. Village after village erupted in protests against taxes imposed by local party officials, and eventually the central government said, "You will not do this anymore. You will stop doing this." And in the early 2000s, redundancy payments for state-owned workers. There's a phrase that gets used a lot when people are talking about national and local. And my apologies in advance to anyone here who actually speaks to Chinese. Tiango Wang Di Yuan. Heaven is high and the emperor is far away. It's an idea that goes back in the dominant ideology of the Chinese states for as far back as written histories go. The emperor is wise and has your interests at heart, but it's the local officials who are evil, thieving bastards. And if only the emperor knew about them, the emperor would do something about them. And this has the obvious advantage: it works as a safety valve. It allows the government to find out where there are real tensions, to replace at fairly low cost. But it also means that people carry on doing it, because if you protest, and if you get rid of the party secretary in your village, and then everything goes back to normal, what the next village notices is not the going back to normal. What the next village notices is you got rid of the party secretary. And hey, if they can do it, we could do it too. So it is a safety valve, but it's a safety valve that's been established because they face this level of localized protest. And it is important to say it is localized. This is not part of a national movement. People overwhelmingly think that they are going up against local officials over local matters, and in part they're able to do so because, of course, scroll right back to the beginning, those local officials now have real economic power. Those local officials can say, yes, we'll abolish the taxes. The factory managers can say, yes, we'll raise your wages. And therefore you go up against the immediate representatives of the ruling class, because those are the people who can actually change things. Now, Tibet and Xinjiang are obviously completely different. Moves there are very directly directed against the central government, but I don't have time to go into those. So when you're in the presence of a tiger, the best place is to be on its back. But ideally, you would like not to be in the same space as the tiger. Now, so the Chinese ruling class can manage the first half. They have no idea. They have no idea how to manage the second half. One of the components of the crisis of strategy, and one of the key constraints on China's rulers now, is that they have to be mindful of popular reaction. One businessman who's quoted in one of the strike studies, slightly exaggerated this when he said China is different from other countries. In the West, it is the rich people who influence politics, and the government fear the rich. Now in China, it is the rich who fear the government, and the government fears the poor. The poor have a high potential to threaten social stability and social order. Notice he's not saying the government are responsive to the poor, the government are a government of the poor, the government fear the poor. And it's an exaggeration. It's an exaggeration, but there's a fundamental point there. The government are worried, and the government are right to be worried, because they don't know that one of these protests won't turn into something that will snowball into something like 1989 again. They can't be certain that at some point there isn't going to be. What they do know is that although each and every local incident has its own immediate specific trigger, there are common causes underlying them. The gap between rich and poor, the corruption of officials, the increasing uncertainty and instability of everyday life. All of those things underlie the various different sorts of movements that come together, and the possibility exists that one of those could spiral out of control. Now, I'm not really going to come to a neat conclusion. I'm going to conclude though. But my aim has really been to outline some of the key issues that China's rulers are facing. To give people some idea of the nature of the crisis of direction that China is facing. None of those things will lead to the immediate collapse, but none of them are capable of an easy solution either. And if China does show us the future of capitalism, if this is China's century, then it's a future as riddled with contradictions and as dangerous to the environment, and actually to us as human beings, as the past of capitalism. And while it shows us the continuing dynamism of capitalism, it also shows us that we need something better, the nationalistic flame war. But the reality is that the very detailed, the very sophisticated electronic surveillance stuff only really works in the big cities. It doesn't work at all in the exporting areas, in terms of stopping strikes, in terms of stopping strikers moving, in terms of stopping strikers being able to not just actually leave the place, but also then carry out road blockades, things like that. It doesn't stop in smaller areas where you have peasant risings. It doesn't stop them being able to riot, set fire to police cars, set fire to the local party headquarters, all this sort of thing. So they could invest in all this sort of thing, but the cost would be astronomical, and of course it's a cost that wouldn't come back. And they do this in place. They do this in Lhasa, in Tibet, in particular, and they do this in the major cities of Xinjiang. And I'll come back to talk about those in a bit. But overall, they can't fall. And around here, if you walk around Beijing, it doesn't feel like living in a police state until you stop and you start to count the number of different uniforms that you see on the street and work out just sort of, you know, about in central Beijing, particularly anywhere around the government places, about 1 in 20 people is in uniform, which means you can probably work out for every uniform copy you can see, there's a plainclothes one that you can't. But get just a few blocks away from that towards the shopping city, and, you know, Wang Fu Jin, the major shopping drag looks exactly the same as Miracle Mile. The shops are pretty much the same as well. The prices are pretty much the same. It doesn't feel to the Chinese middle classes like they are living in a dictatorship. There is a freedom of the press as long as it stays off certain topics. There are multiple TV channels. You're not daily having people tell you what to do. And David's right about the limits of liberalisation. And again, Tibet and Xinjiang are the key things that, you know, you cannot allow people to freely vote for the politicians that they would like to, because if you allowed people to vote in Tibet, they would vote for the Dalai Lama. And if you allowed people in Xinjiang to vote, they would vote for some species of Uyghur nationalist or Islamic independentist. You know, there's no question, if you look at the regimes of occupation in those two places, that the Chinese state is very clear that they hold those places by force, and they will continue to hold those places by force. And it's true that there are elections in villages, and actually those elections in villages do now persist. What they did was, because they started off by electing the village government and the local CCB branch just rigged those elections, what they now do is they have elections for the secretary of the CCP branch. And that then produces the person who's going to be, but they open up those elections outside. So at the local level, you do get that sense that people can do, and it is a system which can co-op. There's a famous village called Wukan, which in 2012 had an occupation where they actually physically threw out the existing village party committee. The provincial party committee came down, ratified the throwing out, supervised new elections, ensured that their favourite candidates won. One of their favourite candidates was the daughter of a guy who had been killed in the protests. He had been a member of the Communist Party. She was a member of the Communist Party. She became one of the councillors in the new village government. So there is the Chinese Communist Party has some 70 million members, roughly, you know, 1 in 12 adults. If you want to advance beyond platoon sergeant, you have to be in the Chinese Communist Party. And the same thing holds in any sort of, in any sphere of the public sector, the same thing. If you want to advance even one or two steps up, you join the Communist Party. And of course you join the Communist Party in order to advance both your own political career, but also financially as well. I mean, and that works for businessmen. There's an author whose name will come to me. He wrote the David Hessler, driving across China, who talks about going to a place outside Beijing, buying a house in the countryside, meeting this guy who is the village entrepreneur, who owns these houses. He opens up to Westerners, owns most of the businesses in the village. The village party committee are at him to join the local party. He doesn't want to because the village party, the two families are fighting each other. Both of them want to put him on his side. He wants to do business with both families. He doesn't want the hassle. He steps back. A year later, the journalist goes back to the village. The entrepreneur has joined the Communist Party. And he's joined the Communist Party because he's expanded his base of operations out of the village to the town at the foot of the mountain. And when he goes down to talk to the officials in the town at the foot of the mountain, it doesn't matter that he goes down there with crates of beer, with cartons of cigarettes. The bribes aren't enough. He also has to be a member of the Communist Party if he's going to do business with the businessmen there. So in a sense, Chinese businessmen don't need their own political party because they're making the Chinese Communist Party into the thing that does the same, into the thing that does the same networking for those. Diane's questions about the relationship between USA and China in East Asia. Of course, it's important to remember there is a history which very long predates any American involvement in this region, which American officials are typically fairly ignorant of. There is the famous quote from Ho Chi Minh when they let the French back into Vietnam in 1946, rather than allow a Chinese army to take over. He said very simply, the French are finished in Asia, they'll be gone in 5 years' time. The last time the Chinese came, they stayed for 1,000 years. We're not having them back. And that sense that China has historically being the power in the region which other governments have had to contend with means that they are looking to the United States as a balance. It doesn't mean, but unlike the Cold War era, when you basically had to choose, are you pro-Russian, are you pro-American, China will happily continue to trade with you, even as you expand military connections with the US, unless you're Taiwan, of course, and therefore America has to do the same. So what you get is that the two become more and more intertwined. But it would be wrong to assume that simply because there are all these economic ties, that therefore there can't be a sudden military explosion. People thought that about Europe in 1914. It turned out not to be true. People keep thinking that. You keep hearing things about there's never been a war between two countries where they had McDonald's. Not true. Yugoslavia in the 1990s. So capitalism, as it becomes more intertwined, also becomes more accident-ridden. Also becomes more. Accident prone, more crisis ridden. Okay, I'm gonna wind up here. I haven't answered all the questions. My apologies. Just the thing about Chinese overinvestment elsewhere, because I didn't know the thing about Jamaican Grenada at all. They don't really appear on the horizon when people talk about Chinese investment, because that mirrors the very real problems that have been in a number of African countries, where Chinese investment has led to sort of big disputes with local workers. I think that as you get greater and greater Chinese investment in these countries, the extent that it causes environmental damage, the extent that it undermines local business, you're going to get all sorts of tensions. At the moment, China trades on, we have no colonial past, we didn't colonize Africa, we didn't colonize. The reality is that the more and more China comes to behave like any other imperialist power, the less application that has, and the more people see China as just another power which sits over the rest of us the way that America does, the way that European does. I want to finish really with the thing about Xi Jinping and the attack on the high level officials, because there is clearly something going on inside the Chinese Communist Party, where they are looking at the fact that they have a crisis of direction, and they're trying to work out how they overcome this crisis of direction. And they are, as I said, you know, they are thinking, what will things be like in 2030, what will things be like in 2040? And there is no simple, obvious answer. And therefore, this is leading to increasing tensions within the ruling class, because on the one hand, there is no obvious answer, there is no obvious strategy which they can grasp and say, this is what we have to do. On the other hand, they can't simply ignore any of the immediate dimensions of crisis. So there is, at the moment, pretty much underground, a real crisis. This is partly why Xi Jinping is cracking down, because he's trying to remove the people who are challenging his authority. And there is a history. It goes back to before 1978. It goes back to Mao. The more the divisions that people will know about the divisions at the top, the greater the divisions at the top, the more space there is for resistance from below. And if those as those divisions inside the Chinese Communist Party, inside the leadership, continue to multiply, as the situation continues to fester, the possibilities of a larger scale struggle against the system become greater. Not by any means, but not by any means certain, not by any means sure. The Chinese ruling class can, for some time to come, carry on managing the crisis. But we should be very clear that what they are doing is managing a crisis which they have created, from which they have no obvious way out. Thank you.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.